Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who in this universe has decided to come on stage. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much, my finest friends. Oh my goodness, I'm caught up. Oh, it's all right. Thank you. Hello, welcome. Thank you for coming along, everyone. You're much better than last week's audience. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Tony the Tiger from off of the Frosties advert the other day. He calls it Rhanasnopus. I don't know if that's going to catch on. Just trying to see if I've got any more stand-up for you. Like, it's been actually like 3 weeks since I've done one of these, and so you'd think a lot of things have happened to me in between that I could be hilarious about. Nothing, absolutely nothing has happened to me. My daughter, Phoebe, nearly 8 years old, 7 years old, has just discovered the Uranus joke. She loves it, and she's going at it like Stuart Lee. I have to tell you, it's absolutely fantastic. What a wonderful moment to realise. But apart from that, not so much. So I'm going to talk to the audience. Got a young man in the front row. What's your name, sir? Rashid. Do I know you, Rashid? Do you ever email me? There's a, okay. Fine, that's all right. There's a Rashid who emails me sometimes. So I thought, what do you do for a living, Rash? Can I call you Rash? Okay. Can I call you What do you do? You're a security officer. What does that mean? What does that involve? You're on a reception. You sit on a reception. Okay, that's a secretary. It's not a security officer. That's the receptionist. That's what that's called. What's the biggest emergency you've averted so far in your job? Have you done anything? No. That's the sign of a good security person, right? That there's never any danger with. Have you got the cushiest job in the world, would you say? Has it worked out? Good. That's good to see. What's your name, sir? Raz. Do you work together? Are you friends? Yeah, don't work together. What do you do? Have you got a proper job? I work in insurance. You work in insurance. Have you ever paid out on anything? You don't do it. I don't do any of that. I don't do the paying out. Just take the money. That's good. Anyway, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming to the Leicester Square Theatre to see the show. Look, let's crack on. We've got an absolute legend. Let's not mess around talking to the audience. We've got an app. Don't, let's not mess around saying we're messing around. Let's just get on with it. We've got an absolute legendary guest for you today. He is best known for playing street punk uncredited in Police Academy 2. Will you please welcome, let's find out if that's true, the incredible Rich Hall, ladies and gentlemen. Street punk. Street punk. Thank you, sir. Come in, sit down, pull up a microphone. How are you doing?
Good evening. Thank you. Great. Yeah. Street punk.
That was early in your career, Police Academy 2?
I'm going to be honest. I don't remember. I'm not sure I'm in that film.
No.
I actually don't remember doing that.
No. I don't think it's on your IMDb page.
I know, but there's a few things on there that are attributed to me that I'm pretty sure I wasn't in.
Okay.
I was in Chud 2. That was about a half a day. Sometimes I'm sure people go, hey, will you do me a favor? Come down and just do this part. Okay, fine. And then later it comes out and you go, oh, my God, really? Wow, Chud 2. Like, you can't even defend that. Like, people go, you weren't even in Chud 1, which is cannibal humanoid underground dwellers.
Okay. And what did you play? What were you in Chud 2?
I guess I was a street punk. I don't know. That's what's attributed to me. I honestly do not remember doing that. If you put me in a movie, it's going to die. There's no question. I don't think I've ever been in a. My voice has been in some good movies.
Okay.
But my face is box office poison. I don't know why people even go, Rich, you want to be in this film? And I go, yeah, okay, I'll be in a film. And then I almost always regret it.
Later. Okay.
And most of them were because somebody owed somebody a favor.
Yeah.
That's pretty much my film career.
Well, in your fantastic new book, I have to say, it's called Nailing It. It's I think one of my favorite, if not my favorite, books about being a stand-up, but also about other things as well. You do write about being in the remake of a mad world.
Yeah.
Which
you might have gone one mad over.
I think I put too many mads in.
I think it was four mads.
Okay.
Yeah. When you come off, I was on Saturday Night Live for a year. And when you come out of Saturday Night Live, you immediately go into a shit film. Like, that's just de rigueur. Yeah. That you have to be in a bad film. It's Pat or, even to me, Animal. I never thought Animal House was a very good film. People swear by it. But when you come out, and I came out and Dino Dealer. Do you want me to tell the story? Dino De Laurentiis, who at that time was about 106, brings me up to his, office in Century City, Los Angeles, and says... And he literally, he's just this bony-fingered guy. But I'm looking at the guy going, oh, my God, this guy produced Serpico, you know. And then by the end of the conversation, I thought, oh, yeah, this guy produced Amityville Horror 2. he said, I'm going to remake Mad World, which is a fantastic film.
Yeah.
And was very much improvised, but just a stellar cast of comedians, you know. And Phil Silvers and Jonathan Winters. And he said, I'm going to remake it. But in my version, the cast loses $4 million, but they lose $1 million in a trash bag, and there will be clues in the film that people can come back to see again and again and again, and they can figure out where this money is hidden. And so I had an agent, and she said, oh, that's great. And I was just thinking, this is the shittiest idea. This is just stupid. And I said, why would you do that? And he walked over to the window, and he said, all right, imagine there's a Cineplex down there, a Twinplex, and this theater is showing Blue Velvet, which is a film that involves multiple rape scenes and a severed ear and a guy huffing a gas mask throughout it. This film is showing... people losing $1 million, and you can earn $1 million by watching the film. Which film are people going to go see? And I just thought, I fucking love David Lynch. Like, people are clearly going to choose the severed ear and the rape over a bunch of idiots running around looking for money in a bag. And then I just made a horrible decision and based almost purely on the amount of money they would offer me. But they also did the thing that you say to a comedian. They said, hey, you can improvise. And when you're a comedian, you go, oh, really? I'm in. Because your ego just starts going, oh, I can make this great. And within 2 days of shooting, we realize, no, this is the turkey. We're turkey stuffing. That's what we are. We are absolute turkey stuffing. And we tried to derail the movie. We tried to derail the money campaign.
Yeah.
By trying to, we figured out where the money was hidden, like through clues in the film. My friend Rick Overton, who's a comedian, I don't know if you've ever met him or not. Brilliant improviser, yeah. But just out of his mind. And we realized that the money was actually hidden on a Navajo in the Navajo reservation in a place called Shiprock, New Mexico, and Rick was out of his mind. He said, "Let's go over there and we'll find something. There'll be coordinates. There'll be something that because the money is just, of course, figuratively hidden. Not,
yes.
They didn't actually hide $1 million in a trash bag, but I just got caught up in it. And plus, I wanted to trash the movie so bad. I even tried to write myself out of the film by saying, what about if I fall off a cliff and I get stuck on an icicle and then the weather changes and it melts and I die? And the director went, oh, you die? I'm like, yeah, I die. I'm out of this in like 3 minutes into the film. And they went, no, you're not getting out of it that easy. No way. So we had to stick around. And it was an awful, awful film.
Yeah.
We ended up on this Navajo reservation and the Bureau of Indian Affairs called us in, and I left a script on the Shiprock Mountain.
Yeah.
I left Rick's script. I stuck it under the car so the Navajo would find it and hopefully, you know, and they did. They found the script and they called us into the BIA office, and the chief literally said, call me chief. He was Navajo, and I went, yeah, I'll call you chief. And he said, what is this? And it looks like a bunch of idiots running around looking for money. And I went, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And he said, so it's hidden on that mountain? I said, no, not really. It's just figuratively hidden on the mountain. And he went, all right, you know, I've already got like 30, 40 people out there crawling around. They're going to break their necks thinking this money is really hidden out there. And so you need to go back and tell the people. I don't know who it is. I said, it's Dino De Laurentiis. Anyway, I don't give a shit who it is. I don't know who that is. Anyway, you tell them they even mentioned Shiprock or anything about the Navajo. We will be on them so fast. And so we had to go back and then they kind of figured out that we'd run off the set.
Yeah.
And so they changed the whole script. They right. rewrote what there was of a script. And we moved to Lake Havasu, Arizona. They changed the film. We had to shoot over Christmas. We didn't get any overtime pay. And it ended up that the money was hidden in the Statue of Liberty's nose. And so that's $1 million. And about 40 people figured that out.
Right.
They gave it to this girl from Bakersfield. They gave her $1 million.
Right.
The film grossed $460,000. They sent us down to Hollywood Boulevard. They sent Rick Overton and I down to Hollywood Boulevard to stand on opening on the, you know, the opening day, stand outside the theater and talk to people about, hey, where do you think the money's hidden? And like 3 people came out, and 2 of them just went, oh, fuck, you know. And the one guy saw us and walked up and went, that film was so bad, I want everybody's money back. It was awful.
Yeah.
I hope you can't find it. Don't go looking for it.
I really want to look for it.
I know. Oh, God.
And I might do. If I find it, I'll tell you where it is on YouTube. This book is fabulous. And I didn't know so much about your earlier career, because obviously you came over to the UK sort of in the late
90s. Yeah, yeah.
But you'd already were a very established force in, as you say, you were in Saturday Night Live, which I think similarly to Janine Garofalo's book, you skip over. It's like to most people, being in Saturday Night Live would be the book would be the, but like,
right.
But it's not. I mean, you don't need to talk about it if you don't want to talk about it because you don't want to talk about it in the book. But it's, you were in Saturday Night Live for a season. But before that, you started out as a street performer, really, but a very sort of avant-garde and risk-taking street performer.
I suppose it, I guess it was risky. I don't know. I had nothing better to do. I quit. For a very brief time, I worked as a journalist. That was, I actually spent 4 years in university studying journalism, edited the student newspaper for a year and a half, got a job in Knoxville, and writing what they call slot notices. The layman's term is obituaries. My job was to, I didn't even know these. I was writing obituaries, and I didn't even have a desk. Like, I borrowed somebody else's desk. My hours were from 9 until 2 in the morning. Whenever the paper was done, all right, Rich, you come in and write up the obituaries. Imagine how creepy that is, even in the daytime, but at night. So I'd get off at, 2 in the morning and just, all I've been doing is basically archiving dead people. And I thought, this is what I studied journalism for? And I went into the editor and I said, how long do I have to do this? And he went, until people stop dying. And I said, I don't know how much longer I could do this. And he said, well, you don't have to. We've got a robot. We've got a computer program that's going to start writing the obituaries pretty soon. Really? Like, at least I'm, investing some kind of emotion into these dead people. You're going to have a computer just chronicling dead people? Yeah, we got the computer coming in. And that never happened, so I quit. Yeah, I quit and became a street performer.
Yeah.
An evangelist. I became a dog evangelist. I baptized dogs.
I mean, but like...
What, that needs more explanation? I baptized dogs.
It's a starting point in comedy. It's, it's pretty out there. I mean, it, admirably so, but it's not even, it's just in... It's almost like sort of a prank show or something. You're just going out into the world and starting something up in the street, right?
It was actually a huge inside collegiate joke. There's a guy named Jed Smock who weirdly only died about a month ago. I actually read his obituary and he was still doing it up to this point.
Written by a computer or by a person?
Yeah. He was a campus evangelist, and he was astounding. And in terms of dealing with hecklers, like, this is before I knew anything about comedy. This guy, Jeb Smock, would come around to campuses in the U.S., and he'd stand out there with a loudhailer, and he'd just go, I don't know why there's whorehouses in this town when you sophomore women are giving it away for free. And, of course, the crowd would just start going, who's this guy? And he would antagonize him so much. My favorite was, listen to this logic, and he would go, son, do you masturbate? And somebody would always go, every chance I get, right? And then he'd go, so you are touching yourself, thus you are touching a man. What does that make you? A homosexual. The Bible is very clear about what happens to homosexuals. They end up in a lake of fire. And people can't even follow the logic. They're going, what? He would literally, there'd be 10 or 15 people at the end of these performances in the middle of the campus who would just come up and get saved, get baptized and everything.
Right.
And then he'd move on to the next campus. And he'd come, and everybody knew who he was, everybody. So I saw him and I just thought, what if, I had no understanding of comedy. I didn't even think of it as comedy. I just thought, what if I could get a crowd together and get them that antagonized and then 15 minutes in just go, God, he's everywhere. He's everywhere. He's in this album, God's Greatest Hits, and turn it into a comedy routine, because I knew the audience would be so worked up. They hated this guy so much that they would just be relieved. And that's what it was. It was street performing, but it was really just a huge practical joke that then I had to follow up with a lot of funny stuff.
Yeah.
I started having to write. But at that point, it was like, well, this is what I'm doing now. I'm street performing and pass a bucket around, and I get a lot of change. And hits of acid and joints. That's what I got every show. There'd be acid and joints
right.
in the bucket with the change. And I take it to the bank and they put it in the hopper. And then they come back and go, here's your $83. And I don't know what this is, but it's yours now. You didn't see us. And so that was my start.
It's it's so unusual and such an individual start, but and it's such a brave. I mean, I suppose you didn't know if you didn't know what comedy was, and you didn't know if you just were doing something. It was just so individual to start.
I didn't really. To me, it was either going to die. Like the idea, the fear when you're a comedian and going into like an open mic or something is a very palpable fear of like, oh, they're going to hate me. I'm going to die. But this was like, not only was there no audience to begin with, I had to build the audience by just yelling through a loudhailer.
Yeah.
But I also hit right away on this idea that, wait, if I baptize dogs, I know there's a payoff at the end. And it was literally this. I had a picture, not much different than this, and I had a picture of dogs playing poker, which is basically the dog version of The Last Supper.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, the Doberman Pinscher is Jesus, and the bulldog passing the ace to the other dog is Judas, right? And so I just did the whole sort of Last Supper thing with the dogs playing poker. And then I'd just call for a dog. And there'd always be a dog. Sooner or later, a dog would show up. And then I'd baptize him. I just said, do you believe in the final fire hydrant? And sort of this weird litany. And they bring the dog up, and they'd hold the dog there. And then I'd just go, I baptize you in the name of, you know, Jesus. And reject all. And I'd pour the water over the dog.
Yeah.
And reject Satan. And every dog, of course, just shakes like crazy. So I knew, all I knew was I had the closing punchline. Yeah. I knew that was going to work. And it always worked. It looked fantastic. I could, if you brought a dog out now, I could make it. I could still do it. And it would look great.
Anyone brought a dog?
And people would just go nuts.
Yeah.
And then I just get in the truck, travel to the next college. And you know, sometimes, you know, I'd hit like Houston Baptist College and it would just be awful. Right. They didn't. But then I just, that didn't work. So I died. Like, I died. I knew I was going to die before I'd even opened my mouth at some places. But yeah, it didn't matter. I'd already set up all this crap, all these props and everything. Well, I'm going to do this anyway.
Yeah.
So the whole, like, mass rejection. But on other places, it was like, they loved it.
Yeah.
You know? And I was making a lot of money. You get to the bigger universities, and I'd have 200 or 300 people in the crowd. Guy came up to me in the University of Maryland, said, my name's John Shear. I'm a music producer, produce tours. Do you want to open for the Talking Heads tomorrow night? And I went, yeah, right. He went, no, I'm John Shear. Here's my card. And he just gave me a card. And he went, do you want to open for the Talking Heads? Give me a call later in my office. And I was asking around. And went, oh, yeah, the Talking Heads are here tomorrow night. I went, holy fuck. And I ended up opening. One day I was street performing, and the next night I was opening for the Talking Heads.
That's insane.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how did that then translate into you going into clubs? And you changed your act, right, when you do that?
I was changing my act. Look, it's just long days of driving down through the prairies and the Midlands, and I had all day to think of new stuff.
Yeah.
And tons of props. I was a gigantic prop comedian, and I didn't really have any. It was so like wide open to what I could do that it never occurred to me that there'd be that I have to struggle for ideas, you know.
Damn.
Granted, it was college kids. It was 18 to 22, and they have a certain sense of humor. It could be very, you know, it could be very physical. And I ate dog biscuits, you know. I'd share them and then collapse into spasms. And go, oh, maybe I got a bad one. That was another. Must have got a bad one, and it was really funny back then. And yeah, and that just sort of evolved into this big kind of. I was a huge. I just had props,
yeah.
And then I started playing other characters, and so by the time I got indoors, I didn't even know how to use a mic. I was just used to yelling through a loudhailer,
yeah.
And it was. At that point, to be able to walk into a comedy club in New York and just see an audience already there was like, really? Wow, I didn't have to go out on the street and gather these people together? This is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a pretty good it was actually a good entree into stand-up comedy.
And then presumably you're coming into clubs and doing something that's pretty different than the most... Or was because in the UK in the 80s, stand-up was quite crazy, and people did a lot of, you know, borderline mentally ill stuff, but very, very performance art stuff. So was there other people doing things like you, or were you sort of standing out as this guy doing props and characters?
Penn and Teller were, I remember seeing them as street performers even before I became a street performer. Right. There was a third member. They were street performers. There was a magician named Harry Anderson who did a show called Night Court, who was very popular. I don't know if he's well known over here, but there quite a number of people who started out as street performers. Robin Williams started out as a street performer.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't recommend it for. I think there's a better way to go, which is to just come up through the clubs because you learn how to be subtle and you don't realize you don't have to yell and be so big. I had to tone it down when I came inside because I was just so. Then the Lord said to the Chihuahua, you know. So you tone it down inside. That's the first thing I learned.
Yeah. I found this when I started out, and I guess when anyone's starting out, what I quite like from the book is, you know, you're talking about other acts, the guys that are sort of either, you know, the other side of mentally ill, either they actually are, you know, the comedians are obviously treading that line, and sometimes they're a bit crazy, and sometimes they're pretending to be a bit crazy, and sometimes they're not. But you get a lot of people in comedy who just are the kind of lost waifs and strays who maybe are a bit crazy. And you talk about one guy in the book who...
Right.
Yeah.
There's tons of them. There's tons of them in America. But I I used to work this diner in New Jersey called the TikTok, and there was a guy... this guy came on every week. It was a gong show. This guy came on every week dressed as General George A. Custer, and he would sing Quando, Quando, Quando. By Engelbert Humperdinck. That's all he did. Had a backing track. Tell me when we'll... And there was a gong, right? And this is New Jersey. They were passing money. It was like Thai boxing, you know, or that. Like people were taking bets on how many quandos this guy would get through before bang, like serious money, dude. Yeah. Like $100 bills floating around, going, he's going to get through six quandos. No, he'll get through five. Hey, and people they hated him, but. They came and they bet on how many quandos he could get through.
Yeah.
And he was a Vietnam vet, and I inadvertently, I won't go into the whole story, but that's like the second or third chapter in the book.
Yeah.
That kind of like turned into my kind of first television break.
Yeah.
Was I sort of borrowed this guy's, I actually found his jacket. He wrecked his car and I helped him, get into the ambulance and everything, and kept his army jacket, his field jacket for Vietnam, and then ended up sort of channeling him during an audition for a TV show.
Yeah.
I just kind of became this guy, and that's how I ended up working on the Letterman show.
Yeah, I had this break and working on. Dave Letterman did a daytime show before.
He did. Yeah, it was very short lived. It was about 8 months. Yeah. It was live. It was live. My first TV gig was live.
Yeah.
So
how long was that? Like all? Was it like? Was it hours long, or was it just
no,
like?
No, it was 90 minutes.
90. Yeah, it was a long show. It was a long. Was it daily or?
It was morning. It was every 5 days a week morning show. They replaced like 3 game shows, and you know, in America, you get rid of somebody's favorite game show, and they are fucking angry, you know. And Letterman was like, this was like. This guy, Fred Silverman, who ran NBC, he just said, we're going to get rid of 3 game shows, and we're going to put in this gap-tooth guy from Indiana. And Letterman was great. I mean, he had, but the morning show was like, we had no idea what we were doing. And we would just go, well, let's just throw watermelons off the roof of the building and film them. And we'd throw them 83 floors off Rockefeller Center and just film it exploding and show it in slow motion. That was like good for 2 minutes right there, just an exploding watermelon, or stupid pet tricks. We came up with that, and that carried on through his whole career. And
yeah,
so we had no idea what we were doing. We had 90 minutes every morning just to fill, and so they ended up. They hired me as a writer, but then they just said, "Hey, you got to go on and do something because we're out of guests," you know. And I was just, "All right, fine. Nobody's watching anyway." We didn't think anybody was watching. Actually, a lot of people were watching. College kids just laying around getting high. But it was good. We won an Emmy. Even we won the Emmy after we'd been canceled.
Okay.
I didn't even get to go. There was no even ceremony. They didn't. No, you're not coming to the ceremony. But they sent my Emmy to the post office in Lower Manhattan, and I had to go down and pick it up.
Yes.
Postage due. I owed like $3 to get my own fucking Emmy. I wasn't even the only one getting an Emmy there. There was another guy from the show as well. We were both down there. Hey, we're here for our Emmys. And we just talk about doing this impromptu Emmy speech at the post office. Well, thank you so much.
But yeah, it's an extraordinary time for American comedy though as well. And you were working alongside Seinfeld and Larry David and doing gigs with all these people that went on to be.
We didn't know what we were doing. I'm sure it was equivalent here, maybe like 8 or 10 years later. You know, when it took off here, it took off in the late '70s and early '80s in America.
Yeah,
there were 3 clubs in New York. And that was it. There were 3 clubs in New York. There was a couple clubs in Los Angeles. And those were your choices. So you either go to L.A. or New York. And I went to New York because there were 3 clubs in Manhattan. What? And you could end up doing 20-minute spots at all of them if you played your cards right.
Yeah.
And I walked into the comic strip in New York and saw Seinfeld even back then. And he was already like he was the stalwart. He was the guy that everybody else held, you know, that's who they looked up to. And he was great. I mean, he just had it, you know. He also worked at it like 6-8 hours a day, you know. So many comedians were just like, get high or whatever. He had an incredible work ethic. Larry David, exact opposite. Just napped. I think he napped all day. And then they'd wake him up and he'd go do a show, and he was vicious. He was vicious. I remember saying, this guy's not cut out for comedy. I remember saying that because we would take bets on how long he'd last on stage.
Yeah.
Anything. Someone would sneeze and he would just, that's it. And he invented the mic drop. He was doing that like 35, 40 years ago. Just, I'm done. Fuck you. Good night. Go, what the hell? That guy's never going to make it.
And you were offered a part on Seinfeld. Is that right? That you didn't do?
No, it wasn't a part. It was just an episode. Yeah.
Right.
I think I was touring. I couldn't get out of. Couldn't do it.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just contractually couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know. I think maybe an opportunity never came up again. So.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a shame, isn't it?
I suppose. Yeah. But given my track record in movies, who's to say it's any better in TV? You know? That would have been oh, God, who remembers the shittiest Seinfeld episode ever? Rich Hall came in and ruined it.
I'd imagine, though, like, if you're in one, I mean, I get, like, a check for 4p every now and again from some radio show I did in 1990. I imagine if you're in Seinfeld one episode, that's probably quite a nice little continuing payday.
Yeah, you
would.
Yeah, because that's probably playing somewhere in the world right now.
Yeah.
Seinfeld and MASH, those shows are still playing every, and Friends, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the royalty system in America is quite generous. That's true.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a shame here. There's no safety net for. Even in TV. Are there any? Yeah.
It's not. I mean, it's such big money, isn't it? If you can get the syndicated series in America. Obviously, if you can get Seinfeld, that's ideal. But anything that's 100 episodes and then it's playing everywhere and then it's.
Then you're a millionaire.
Yeah.
Yeah. If that's what you're in it for. I'm not in it for that. I have no interest in being a millionaire. I honestly can tell you, I've never done anything for the money except Million Dollar Mystery. That's where I learned my lesson. Yeah. Never do it for the money. Forget the money, you know. Forget it.
No, I think that's true.
Yeah.
But you know, it's also nice if they do pay you, though.
Yeah. I'm only saying that now because no one's offering me £1 million. I probably would take £1 million to.
Right.
At my age, at this point in my career, I'll fucking sell hemorrhoid products. I will. For $1 million? Yeah. Yeah. I will.
I think you've got it.
Because the whole remember the idea of selling out? I was thinking about this the other day. Like, that was real. Selling out as an artistic ethical idea.
Yeah.
I don't think it exists anymore. I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, I don't think anybody holds you. There's very few purists who say, oh, he sold out when he, You know, I think everybody now knows, yeah, they offered him a lot of money, so he did it.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Dylan is selling Ford trucks or whatever, you know? Of course he is, for the money.
Yeah.
Like, no one holds it against him. But there was a long period in my early career where it's like, nah, I'm not selling out, man. I am not selling out.
Yeah. But I think that's true, and that's true of a lot of people, I think, in this country as well. It did. It sort of just, I think it sort of changed in the 90s, and then definitely as we got into this century, it sort of, I think the new comics wouldn't bat an eye, you know, if they get an ad, and understandably, it's fair enough. I think it's sort of weird when it's, for me, it was always, if it was like a big, big name who's already a millionaire, and then they're taking another 10 million to do, so you kind of think, what do you do with all this money? But then I think that's about all of these super rich people, you know, what's Elon Musk doing with his $200 billion?
Bob Dylan's just sold his back catalog, and I don't think he needs the money.
No.
I think you got to do something with it. If you have all these publishing rights, Springsteen, people like that, are like, what are you going to do with it? You might as well just sell it and use the money for something.
Yeah.
Because eventually it's gonna be public domain anyway. You mm-hmm. know. So.
What would you do catalog. If you had a back catalog? If the Otis Lee Crenshaw back catalog was sold for $70 million?
Yeah.
What would you do with $70 million?
I would sell my back catalog for 7,000 pounds. If somebody wanted to take one of my songs and record them and good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a lot of my favorite songwriters aren't making, they're making a living because somebody else recorded their song.
Yeah.
And then somebody, oh, yeah, I love that song by so-and-so. And I get to go, no, that's not who wrote it. And I get that moment of satisfaction going, I think you'll find that Take It Easy was written by Jackson Browne. People go, who gives a shit?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
But you did have, you know, you did have this early success, and you must have done, again, people in the UK won't know about this. I didn't really know about this. You were in the American version of Not the 9 o'clock News, basically.
Yeah.
And you did a section called Sniglets.
Right.
In which you gave definitions to words that don't...
Words that should be in the dictionary but never made it. Yeah.
But you did. There was a lot of books of this. So, like, you became the Sniglets guy in America.
Yeah. That's one of the main reasons I came over here. It was a weird kind of success backfire kind of thing.
Yeah.
In that I had these books that were bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list and everything. In the how-to advice miscellaneous.
Yeah.
It wasn't fiction, it wasn't nonfiction, it was under how to advice miscellaneous. So I was always just right behind the Rand McNally Road Atlas. It really pissed me off too. I really started to hate the fucking Road Atlas. Like I couldn't eclipse Rand McNally Road Atlas.
Yeah, they had it coming though, Rich. That Road Atlas won't be selling anything now.
Exactly. But then again, nobody's buying my books either. So but it was a weird situation in that they were popular, but they didn't work on the stage. Like, right. I could do them right now, and I could probably do two that you would go, oh, that's It's kind of funny, but not really. It was, it was a textual thing, right? It was like, these work as a book. But, of course, the club owners are going, hey, the guy wrote Stiglitz. He's playing this weekend. And so people show up, and the club owners didn't care. You know, they were snakes. They were like, yeah, let's just get the asses in the seats. And I'd walk out on stage, and I'd be like 10 minutes in, and then you'd start hearing it, Stiglitz! Stiglitz! And I don't really... They're not going to work, people. No, come on, do some Stiglitz. And it was really... And then I get angry. Talking, fuck you, I'm not doing the Stiglitz. And then the crowd would go, why is he so angry? We just want to hear his funny words. Like I would say, I can't... It's like Gary Larson coming out and trying to describe a Far Side cartoon, okay? It's just not going to be that effective.
Yeah.
And I'm literally on stage arguing my way out of a request, you know? It'd be like the Who go on and play My Generation. And they go, let me explain why we don't want to do that song. And you just go, what? Fucking just play the song. We requested it. And I couldn't. You can't argue with an audience that something's not funny, because that inherently is not funny. So there's no way to. I was trying to figure out, how can I turn this argument that I'm not going to do Stiglitz and make it funny? And it just didn't work. It was just, now the crowd is going, but they promised that you'd... Oh, fuck. So I came over here to do Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And didn't have to... Nobody cared. Nobody knew about that. I was just a lodestone that I just managed to drop like that. And also... I was on the American Club Circuit, and if you know anything about the American Club Circuit, which pretty much still exists, it's just, you go in on a Thursday night to Sir Laughs-A-Lot, you know, or P.O. Pants, or some stupid, stupid, horrible chain club, and all the tables are lined up like Oktoberfest. Like, nobody's even looking at you. They're all facing each other and looking up like that at stage, and they're selling the jalapeno poppers and... fucking mixed drinks. There's always a blender going on. There's a 2-drink minimum as you come in, even if you don't drink alcohol. You have to order 2 drinks. Like, the audience has been raped before they ever sit down, right? They've just been treated like shit. And then the local guy comes out, and he's like, has all the local references because he's a Detroit comic, you know?
Yeah.
So he does that. And then they bring in a middle guy who's the rest of the time. You have to, he spends the week following you around, watching you buy stuff at the mall, right? And he does 20 minutes. And then you come out and you do 45 minutes. And about 35 minutes in, the waitresses just come around and drop the checks on the table. And people have to pay up while you're on stage.
Right, yeah.
Imagine right now. Hey, pay up. Pay up, everybody. The waitresses were coming through right now asking you to get out your credit cards and money while we're trying to do a show.
Yeah.
So... all the momentum you've built as in that first 35 minutes, now you have to have 5 minutes of just treading water material. And then, of course, now they're paid up, and they're like, fuck, who the fuck ordered 3 pina coladas? So now they're like, well, this better be worth it. And now they're looking back up at you like, you better make this worth our while, because this is way more than we thought it was going to cost.
Yeah.
And you're under pressure to deliver this incredible closing bit. So you end up having to struggle to... well, what's my closing bit? You don't get to just shift things around. You really have to have a very structured show. That's
sure.
And it's a great way to make a living financially. You could make a good living. There's tons of comedians in America who that's what they do. They play the clubs, and they're great comedians. They're great club comics. I got to Edinburgh, and it was all different. It was just, I'll buy a pint. I'll buy a ticket. I'm going to come in and sit down. You make me laugh. In this cave, because, you know, Edinburgh was... I walked into places in Edinburgh and went, there can't possibly be a show here. There can't possibly. I was in these vaults where you could just stick your hand in the wall and pull out chunks of the fucking wall. And just, fuck, it's like a snowball. And they were doing comedy in there. And I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I just thought, so this whole town just... they just turn everything into a... and comedy was king, even when I first got there. It was, you know, the Fringe was just... it just blew my mind. It's just, so all I have to do is just go up on an hour and nobody... there's going to be no waitresses, no checks. No, just please, God, make us laugh. Please, make us laugh. And I thought it was great.
And you basically just put together a show, like, on the hoof, ready for that first...
Yeah,
is that true?
Yeah. I didn't really have the hour.
Yeah.
you know, it all, so much of it now is, do you have your Edinburgh hour? And I went, I got hours and hours of funny stuff. Is there supposed to be, well, it needs to be fluid. It'll be fluid. Like, I didn't even think about it. I just thought, I'm going to go, I'll be funny for an hour. And yeah. I changed it around a lot. And I was trying to add a lot of new stuff. And my promoter, Marlena Zwickler, you probably know Marlena.
Yeah.
She was adamant. She says, can you just, like, get a show that works and stop fucking around? I tried to recreate the Scott Monument out of cornflakes and Raisin Bran. All right, I had this great idea. I had this great idea one morning, and what it was I'm going to build the Scott Memorial out of all cornflakes boxes, because I went down to Morrison's, and they were, like, selling old cornflakes for, like, 20p a box. And I went, fuck, this is amazing. Like, I could buy 200 boxes of cornflakes. This is fantastic. And I did. It took me, like, 4 trips to get them all back to the flat. And I reconstructed the Scott Monument. But in the middle was one Raisin Bran. Like, everything was cornflakes, but one Raisin Bran. Yeah. And for some reason, I thought this was going to be hilarious. I just thought everybody could see it. I built it. It took me, like, an hour before the show. I'd have to, like, build it and get it all the way up to the ceiling. I was in a huge room at the University of Edinburgh. And it was patently obvious that there was one Raisin Bran that was kind of at the bottom, that if you pulled that out, the whole thing would collapse, right? The tower, like, just picture a tower going all the way up there, but you pull that one box out, and it all just falls all around me. I just thought, well, this is going to be great. All I have to do is ask someone, fellow, would you like some cereal? And give him a bowl and some milk and say, what kind of cereal would you like? And I just misread the nature of Brits, because I just figured these people are so evil. Of course, they're going to go the Raisin Bran, just so they can watch the whole thing collapse. Yeah. That's fucking hilarious. And I built it the first night, and I went, all right, fellow, which kind of cereal would you want? And he went, cornflakes. And I went, no, you sure you want? Yeah, I don't like Raisin. You don't want Raisin? I don't like Raisin Bran. Anyway, you don't like. And then I started trying. Can you not see what I'm trying to do here, fella? I've spent hours building this thing. You are supposed to say, I'll have the Raisin Bran. Then we watch the thing collapse, and it's hilarious. And he went, I don't like Raisin Bran. I can't digest raisins. And he went, oh, for fuck's sake. And I just went over and just kicked the Raisin Bran. The whole thing collapsed. And at that point, people were going, the fuck was that all about? Why did he just destroy his own tower? It was. And then, of course, there's another 20 minutes of, like, I'll try. So anyway, I'm just surrounded. Just a mountain of fucking cornflakes everywhere. Yeah. And I'm in the middle of it going, so anyway, what about that? Bill Clinton, huh? He's like a people going, what the fuck is he? What's that? What was that all about? Just and Marlena just, she walked up and she went, you can't just buy your act at Morrison's. And I went, no, I'm doing it again tomorrow. She didn't, you're not doing it again. And so I took all the cornflakes back. And I lived in a flat full of cornflakes.
So you just did that one time. I mean, nobody else would think of doing that. I can't imagine anyone thinking of that idea.
No. I just thought it'd be fun.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
I was so certain of the public. I thought I'd read the crowds. Of course they're going to want the Raisin Bran, because in the thing, nope, I like cornflakes. Oh, fuck's sake. Yeah.
Let me ask you some emergency questions before I'm going to come back, because it's really fascinating to hear all this. And I must just say again, the book is fantastic. It's called Nailing It. There's a lot more in it than we're going to be talking about, but really fantastic stories, unbelievable stories, some of them, but I believe they are true. I will ask you this question. Do you think your obituary photo has already been taken, Rich Hall, or do you think it's yet to come? And what do you think your the photo of your, seeing you're an obituary man, what do you think, which photo do you think they'll use in your obituary?
No.
If it's been taken.
Nah, I don't think it has.
No.
No.
You think the best is yet to come is what you're saying really there?
No,
saying.
No, I think they'll just go pull something off Google when I kick the bucket. Instagram. It probably won't even be me. That's got to be embarrassing, right? They stick the wrong picture in your obituary photo.
Yeah.
You know, or even worse, Mo Sizlak. They could put that in there. They could put that in there in a second.
Yeah, I guess they will.
They're going to be me and then Mo.
Yeah.
So God,
what is this? How did Mo from The Simpsons end up with your face?
Okay. I'm not even exactly sure. I worked with Harry Shearer on Saturday Night Live, and yeah. He used to do a great impression of me. Right. But he could do impressions of a lot of people. And he would come around, and he would do an impression of me. I also worked with a couple other writers who went on to write a lot of Simpsons. But Harry doesn't do the Moe's Sizlak voice. It was, right. Is it Hank Azaria?
I think it is. Yeah.
I think that Harry Shearer just went, why don't you make it sound like Rich Hall? And he went, yeah, I could do Rich Hall, because Hank Azaria can do anybody, right? And so they just kind of ended up going, just make it sound like Rich Hall. You know, kind of Rich Hall. And somehow that, I also think there might be some physical resemblance. Possibly. A couple Halloweens ago, I went out as Mo with my kid, and it was pretty impressive. It was pretty good.
Yeah,
my kid painted me yellow, and I had a tray and the apron, and I walked around with the beer, you know.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it's a weird because those cartoons will be shown. I think they'll probably still be going in 50 years' time, maybe. You know.
Yeah.
That whatever, you know, probably beyond the time that anyone's going to remember Rich Hall or anything Rich Hall did.
Yes.
50, 100 years' time. Hopefully some people.
And again, if I cared about money, I'd be demanding a shitload of royalties for image likeness. But I don't care. I'm honored. Only because Moe's pretty fucking funny. Yeah. You know? He makes me laugh. He's also based actually on Red's Bar, which was a tavern in New Jersey. All that... that old joke, Red would get these calls from people going, hey, I'm looking for Amanda. Who? Amanda. Amanda Hug Me? And he fell for it. These tapes exist.
Right.
You can find them. And he'd fall for it every time, Red.
Yeah.
I'm looking for Amanda Hug Me. Oh, you son of a bitch. I'll kill you. I'll rip your liver out. That it's kind of a combination of those two things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. There's Ben Moore, who's a fantastic English sort of performance comedian actor, but the film Arthur Christmas, which you're actually also in as a voice, is based on him as a young. They took a photo of him as a young man and mate, and Arthur Christmas is him as a young man.
Really?
But he never got paid. I mean, I keep on saying to him, they should have paid you for that. Because they've taken your image and they've used you. But I think, again, he sees it as being just a nice thing to happen. That's an odd... I mean, that's going to be a big... You know, that's a big thing, people taking people's image and doing other things with it. It's going to... You know, probably this might not happen to you, Rich, but they can put you in porn films and things now. So someone could take that image and put you in a porn film against your will. So that's a big question, isn't it? Ethical question.
You mean now in my current...
Yeah, they could take...
That's scary. A younger Rich Hall, I wouldn't mind seeing. Yeah,
yeah.
They could sort of image me in a younger. I could enjoy that vicariously.
Yeah. Well, that might be. That might all be part of it.
Both of us. I would have seen myself in a porn film 30 years ago. Fuck yeah! I'm like, wow. Oh God, my feet. You know what? My feet would be dirty. Remember early porn? They fucking didn't wash their feet. That really ruined it for me. There's a lot of dirty feet in the early days of porn. And you just go, oh, man, I'm this, you know, I'm trying to follow the plot, but fucking...
let's creep... Oh, man, I knew we wouldn't get through anything. Yeah, shut up. There's so much to talk about. But let's quickly talk about Otis Lee Crenshaw. How did that came about through, like, a chat show or something in Australia, right?
Linda Gibson. I just kind of channeled a lot of relatives from my backwoods relatives, I like to call them.
Right.
I'm a southerner. I've got some people in my family tree that are wow. And they'd show up at Christmas, and so I just kind of created this amalgam character of those kind of several of my cousins. I don't even know if they're cousins.
Yeah.
I have people show up going, I'm one of your cousins. And I'm like, I don't think you are, but, you know, I'll take your word for it. And I wanted to do musical comedy, which I think I never thought about in America. But when I got over here and I saw Bill Bailey and people like that, I thought, oh, that's how you do musical comedy.
Yeah.
Because America, it was like just a guy coming out with a guitar and playing 8 minutes of American Pie with, you know, he changed the lyrics.
Changed the lyrics, yeah.
Like, I remember seeing a guy play, literally, do a filthy version of American Pie that was actually longer than American Pie. Like, you actually made this longer? And it was kind of, you were kind of stigmatized, I think, if you were a musical comedian. That's changed a lot because there are some great American musical comedians. But back then, it was just not.
Well, it's difficult. I think it's a very difficult thing to get around. The people who do it right, I think, you know, it's sort of sublime. It's actually my favorite kind of music is brilliant comedy.
Yeah.
That combine comedy and music brilliantly. So you know, it's very difficult, very rare that people can do both, right? Because it's two very different skills, really.
Yeah.
And Bill's great. Tim Minchin's a fantastic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I saw Bill, who's so classically trained and so, like, almost blasphemous about some of the stuff he does, like what he does with classical music. But it's obvious he had every he had a tremendous musical background. And I looked at that and went, God, that looks like fun. I like to do that. The only difference was I had no musical training. None. Like, I never even picked up a guitar or anything.
Right.
But I thought, I want to write songs. And I thought, okay, the best way to do this is, how about create a character who's actually just not a very good musician, but thinks he is and can't understand why no one in Nashville is recording his songs, even though he spent most of his time in prison and most of the songs are about prison rape or trying to communicate through glass with, you know. Yeah. So and it was another kind of late night, you know, in Edinburgh back when I was first doing it. It's like, you do your regular show and then, we'll give you a room late at night. Go just do something crazy. And you would, you know. And so it kind of came out of that. I just started teaching myself piano, surrounded myself with some really good musicians, had lots of guests on, some of who were just unbelievable jerks. And, but I still got to meet them.
Yeah.
But and then out of that, I slowly just got somewhat better.
I mean, there's a great story in the book about in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
About a couple of people coming to us who believing Otis to be real, right?
There were people who thought I was. It's kind of the Al Murray thing.
Yeah.
I think he gets a certain amount of people who still don't know that it's a character.
Right.
You know, probably less and less. But I guarantee you there's still people who go, like, oh, man, that guy's right on the money. He says it the way it is. He goes, no, it's a character. And Otis Lee Grinshaw was like that. A lot of people just thought, hey, man, they'd see me on the street. And I didn't even look like Otis on the street. They'd go, Otis, why? Where's your bandana, man? I had a Confederate bandana. I think there's a lot of, I'm not sure that I could even do Otis anymore.
No. And it became too much. And was it partly because you ended up going to a funeral and playing a funeral?
Yeah. This couple in Australia showed up and said the granddad had just either killed himself or accidentally driven off of a 6-story car park.
Okay.
Reversed. Couldn't get to the bottom of it. Didn't matter. One or the other. Like the brother, it was a brother and sister, and the brother thought he'd topped himself, and the sister was pretty sure he just hit the wrong gear. And they said they came to see my show in Sydney, in Adelaide, and said, you are our granddad's favorite comedian, you and Kevin Bloody Wilson. All right. And he would have, you need to come to his funeral. And the conversation went on like that. And then the girl started singing a song that I'd written. She knew it, and she had a great voice. And it just kind of, it reached this point where it was too late to go, I'm not really. They were too immersed in thinking I was Otis that I'd reached this point where I'll just go with this. And so the next day I went to their funeral as Otis Lee Crenshaw. I was also kind of like struggling for ideas. I just thought, well, this could be interesting. I'll go to a funeral as Otis Lee Crenshaw and just see what happens. And I ended up literally writing a song. I was there for about 4 hours, and I just offered to write a eulogy for, and I ended up writing a song about Bundaberg rum.
Yeah.
Which everyone was smashed on. Unbelievable. Like, I don't know if anybody knows about Bundaberg, but it's, or it's like Buckfast, but right. even with, but with jet fuel, right? It's just vicious. And it's a real kind of redneck bogan. Australians have about 9 different words for redneck. So,
yeah.
So I was in my element, right?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, right. Hoon, bogans, bevins. So, I ended up writing this song about Bundaberg rum, which was like an anthem for Bundaberg rum. And then I did it on the gala on TV in Australia. And then all of a sudden I had 2 different factions of people coming to see me. I had people like, you know, the sublime audience like this and this other group of people who were just, it was Snicklets all over again. It was like, sing the Bundaberg song. We love Bundaberg rum. And they were in the back starting fist fights because the fucking bar didn't sell Bundaberg rum. One of the shittiest gigs I ever played was the Sydney Opera House. I know. It was unbelievable. It was awful. There were fights. It smelled like vomit. It was I'm standing outside. I'm playing the Sydney Opera House, and it just turned into a fist fight.
Yeah.
It was. I remember Jason Byrne was on. He was on before me, and he was on after me, and. He came to the dressing room. The fuck? The place smells like vomit. And I went, I know it's Bundaberg rum. They're sneaking it in, and I don't know what happened. And he said, "Oh, for God's sake, did you sing that Bundaberg?" And I went, yeah, I don't know what happened. I'm getting this audience who thinks it's an anthem. Like the lyrics of the song were about how vicious, how much it fucks you up.
Yeah,
they didn't care. They loved that. They loved it. Makes you want to call the bouncer a big fat poof. They love that line. Want to peel you from the roof, makes you go on to call the bouncer. Sing the Bundaberg. And when I got back to London, I just thought, I think Otis is done. That was kind of the nail in the coffin.
It's interesting. It's really interesting, but it's also interesting because I don't think, you're the kind of person who it really comes across in this book. Something will be proposed. And you'll go, where most people would go, no.
Yeah,
I'm not coming to a funeral dressed as Otis Lee Crenshaw.
Yeah.
You go with it, and then it leads places, and they can be disastrous, and it can be, but both of those, Sniglets and that, it's really fascinating to get something that is a success, but then becomes this terrible kind of cross to bear as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's such a weird...
I don't know if it's my fault or it's just kismet, you know? It's just like, well, that happened and I'm not doing that anymore.
But then to be able to dump it as well, but also to have so many ideas, which you do, and you're really... I mean, using the word comedy genius is overused, but just your genius is to come up with all this stuff.
And while you're saying that, there's a bug flying around my head. See there? There's an insect looking for a place to land on my head while you're calling me a genius.
You're a genius. You're a good landing place for insects. You've got everything going on for you. You can go, right, I'm going to leave the country. I'm going to leave Australia and never do that character again. I'm going to leave America and not do Sniglets again. But you've got enough stuff that it doesn't matter. So for some people, that would be a lifetime of, God, I've got to go out and do this song for people who are puking up in each other's faces. But, because it's also beautiful that you created that song for a funeral and it worked in the funeral. So, it's you're not in control, are you, as the creator of where something goes?
No, but I think, I'm only realizing this now, that in both of those instances, you give up something and then it opens you up creatively to new possibilities.
Yeah.
You know, if I could have milked Sniglets and been I could still be doing them.
Yeah.
But I went, and then that brought me to Edinburgh, and then that brought me to an audience here, and I prefer doing comedy in Britain to America. I like doing comedy in America, but it's better here. It's more of an art. I wouldn't, look, this is a theater. This isn't Uncle Fucker's Chuckle Hutch. Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Cleveland?
And so you're now touring, on your tours now, so there's you're doing stand-up and then do you do a second half that's sort of musical?
Yeah, the second half is very improvisational music, which personally I think is better than Otis. It's just because it's more wide open, and it's also, there's a lot of thinking on my feet, which is great.
Yeah.
I have a really good musicians to back me when I suck, you know. I can hit a bum note, and it doesn't matter. It's comedy, you know. So I don't have to worry about it too much. Yeah. I do worry about it. I do dread. I mean, I want to be a better guitarist all the time. So I work at it a lot, but I'm not ever going to. And my real guitarist is over here just, how the fuck did he do that, you know?
But then you've still, like, learned the guitar from, as an adult, halfway through your life, you've started, I'm going to start doing this.
Yeah, and so, I'll tell you what, if there's any guitarist, then there's never a point where you cannot be better.
Yeah.
I've reached the point where I'm never going to be a better comedian than I was in the past. But, musically, you can always... There's always something else you can improve on.
Yeah.
I think that's true of comedy as well. I think I'm probably, I think about four, I'm about 4 years away from peaking. I think 2026 is my year.
Yeah. I think that's good. I think there's always, I think it's, you know, anything creative thing is interesting. And I think your career is so fascinating because there's so much success in there. And you are, you know, you are without doubt one of the most successful comedians in the world. And yet you're very modest about that. And I think you would still feel, from what I've heard and read, I don't think you would describe yourself as that necessarily. So there's always, but then that's a good thing. That's a good thing to be, because you're always striving to improve, you know, and to get better. And it doesn't feel to me like you're not a comedian who coasts, and you're not a comedian who's running out of ideas either. So
No. But if you ask my wife, she would tell you I'm a massive failure. She's the one who told me there's a one-eyed Boston Terrier in our neighborhood named Lucky Pierre, who's got like 80,000 Twitter followers. Why would you... How am I supposed to respond to that? What? So I should just get a... How I should build up my Twitter account? How? That's a dog. He's a one-eyed Boston Terrier. He's cute. I guess he's funny. Maybe he does tricks. I don't... Why would you throw that... That's your measure of success? There's a one-eyed Boston Terrier who's... He's not fucking living in a mansion, is he? He's still shitting in the backyard and eating dog food. So how much of a success is he? But to her, it's like... You don't have 80,000 Twitter followers. I don't have any Twitter followers. I can't manage. I don't.
Twitter's dead anyway, Rich. You made the right choice. Twitter's gone. So how do you? What do you feel about you? How would you describe yourself? How do you feel? Do you feel? You seem quite a content.
Yeah.
Person.
Yeah.
Which is so you're not like some comedians have this driving ambition.
Oh, well,
to be the best comedian, to keep on pushing and the. Envious of other comedians and, you know, always looking over their shoulder or looking over the shoulder of the person ahead of them.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like you.
Well, that's just the nature of their personality and drive and ambition. And if they were preacher, you know, I always look at vicars and preachers and priests and think, we're kind of in the same business, right? In a way, we come out and we just talk and the people gather around and they of course have a spiritual message and we're just making people laugh. But I always think they must be way more competitive than, you know, they're going home going, fuck it, look at that fucking, that guy sucks. You know, that guy over at First Baptist Houston, he sucks. He's awful. He's terrible. How does he get a congregation? He's terrible. Doesn't even know his biblical verses. He gets them backwards. I'll bet they're like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you would be, if your nature is to be competitive, it doesn't matter what you're doing, be a truck driver and go, I got to be a better truck driver, you know? I can't believe Joe over there is fucking getting that gig, you know? Yeah. Or you can be someone who's just like, this is the luckiest career choice in the world. Like, what? Here's what you do, all right? You can sleep as late as you want, and then you can get up, and then you write some funny shit, or don't. Doesn't matter. Probably should, but you don't have to. No one's putting a gun to your head. And then you'll go out at night, and you'll stand on a stage, and you'll talk, and people will laugh at you. And then you go backstage, and they hand you money. Like, really? Yeah, that's a career choice. You can do that. All right. Like, that's pretty much good enough, you know.
Yeah.
If I can keep doing that.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's just making drunks laugh. Yeah. You're entertaining drunks.
And fight each other and be sick.
There's a line in the book toward the beginning that a musician quoted named Ray Wiley Hubbard, and it's the best description of show business. He says, there's two kinds of people. There's daytime people and there's nighttime people. And it's the nighttime people's job to get the daytime people's money.
Yeah. It's good. And towards the end of the book, you talk about how comedians now don't have, you know, I think, again, when you started and when I started as well, to an extent, comedians were this sort of, it was like, this wasn't a career choice. This was just something you were doing for fun.
Yeah.
The comedians seemed like they were rebels, renegades, and self-saboteurs. And
yeah.
You don't think those, apart from, you mentioned Doug Stanhope as a possible exception, but
right.
You know, there's not people like Bill Hicks and Sam Kinison coming through.
I don't know of them. I'm just saying that of the comedians that I have seen, there aren't, it doesn't, I think those days where your lifestyle fueled your comedy are, there's not that many comedians anymore. I mean, they don't, most of them self-destruct anyway because it's their nature to self-destruct. That's also what makes them incredibly funny or you know, you just go, whoa. I mean, Sam, I don't know if people here are familiar with Sam Kinison, but that was, he was rock and roll comedy. He took comedy and turned it into rock and roll,
yeah.
You know. And traveled with an entourage, all this stuff. And then he'd come out on stage and he'd be electrified. But I would look at him and think, if that's what it takes to be that funny, I'll be marginally funny because I couldn't live like that. And he didn't live like that. Bill Hicks didn't, well, quit drinking, quit smoking, and then got pancreatic cancer. So, but their lifestyle, I mean, their comedy was, they were just really dark, crazy, visceral people who just went to places, did things to their brain and their bodies and their lifestyle that informed their comedy. And they were mesmerizing. But I don't blame, I wouldn't suggest that kind of lifestyle to anyone because you're going to die, you know, or burn out. And so it's probably a safer, you know, comedy now is like, I bemoan the fact that there aren't people like that, but I still don't recommend it, you know.
No. But it is interesting. I mean, I don't know if there could ever be another Rich Hall, though, you know. I mean, and you're not a self-destructive comedian, but you're particularly not comparatively to
most. Oh, he came on stage with a beer.
he drank the whole thing.
Back
in
off,
an hour.
Caligula.
Yeah. But, you know, I can't... I mean, I don't think there ever was anyone else like you anyway. There's something... Your brain works in a different way, which I suppose comedians need to have that, and it'll be another comedian that will work in a different way to Rich Hall.
Yeah.
I don't think there'll be another Rich Hall.
But your brain works different. That's why you're a comedian. That's why you're still, you know... I think you have to figure out, well, how can I... You do find your voice at a certain point.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. Everybody starts out emulating somebody else. You know, I basically ripped off a preacher. I mean, not even a comedian. I just ripped off a preacher's and just made it funny. But then you eventually do find your voice. And once you found that, then you, all you have left is the hurdle, the societal hurdles that kind of put up certain roadblocks. Like, well, that doesn't work anymore. You can't get away with that.
Yeah.
So like I said earlier about Otis, I don't think I could get away with it anymore. I'm not sure. I'd have to figure out some way around. How can I come out here with a bandana? And he'd have to, I don't know, you know.
Yeah, you'd need to change it. But, you know, but equally, you know, the great thing is that you made that decision irrespective. You know, it came to an end on your terms in any case.
Yeah.
I mean, changing the bandana, you know, you would have to probably change the bandana because... yeah. someone would go, you can't have that flag, even though the yeah. point you're, even though you're, the point it's making is yeah. Is on their side. Some people wouldn't get it. Maybe, but yeah, it's. I mean, yeah. things change. But you have to be able to adapt a little bit as a comedian, you know, unless you are always on a level.
I think you constantly have to adapt. Yeah. I think we, you know, the stuff that you could talk about 5 years ago is to a lot of people is just like, right. It's just, you just keep staying ahead of hackdom, if that's a word. Is that a word? Hackdom, yeah. Stay ahead of that. Stay ahead of the game.
Well, that's the worst sin, really, isn't it, as a comedian? It's not being offensive. It's not being original. It's being it's doing the obvious.
Yeah.
Which again, I think is something you've managed to stay ahead of and avoid.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, I haven't seen every single thing you've done, Rich.
Oh no, we
can all be hack at some point.
No,
sure,
no. But. Well, that's why I wrote this book because I have such a sterling, pristine career that I thought people should read about all the shitty gigs I did. That is worth reading. I didn't want to. The last thing I wanted to do was write another. Hey, here's how I look. What I did here. Look what I accomplished. This. That's just shoving it in people's faces.
Yeah.
I'm famous and you're not. Read my book. Fuck you. Why would I buy your book? What you want to do is write a book about. Here's some things that really fucked up, and anybody can relate to that. They can go, you know, and it's way more entertaining. And so that's.
Well,
that's
I know, but also your fuck up. So like Sniglets and people shouting that at you. Was horrible for you at the time, but it's fucking funny to hear about now that you were trying to go on stage and do your comedy and then people wanted something that wouldn't work. It's brilliant, you know, it's a brilliant story in retrospect, which again, I suppose most comedians, you go through something terrible and you kind of know that with a bit of distance or it's going to be it's going to be funny anyway, so you sort of can't lose as a comedian. It's nice. Look, the book's fantastic. Do buy. I got the audio book, which is the best way to get it because you get Rich reading it to you, which is lovely. I've also got I bought it twice. I got the book and the audio book. That's the kind of guy I am. That's very, very supportive.
Slowly pushing me up the bestseller. One Richard Herring purchase at a time.
That's two copies every podcast. Imagine that. But someone else will buy it now as well and pass it on. And you're on tour through 2023 as well. It's the new tour 2023. Yeah. So go and see Rich live all over the world, back in America, UK, Australia.
Yeah, I think I'm doing Australia. Yeah. But I'm doing Pocklington.
That's where I was born, Rich.
I know.
Good. Well, you've done your research.
And I know that theater.
It's
a great theater.
It is lovely theater.
Yeah, I went to see somebody else there by accident. I mean, not by accident. That's a great theater.
We'll get you on again because we haven't talked about your documentaries. We haven't talked about so much other stuff we could talk about. But what a fascinating career. What a fantastic man. What a brilliant stand-up comedian. Will you please give it up for Rich Hall, ladies and gentlemen? You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Rich Hall. Thank you to Scant Regard for playing the music for this show. I am indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, and all of his lovely team of merry men today. Thank you very much to the Leicester Square Theatre for having us. Do check out leicestersquaretheatre.com. They've got some fantastic shows on here, plus Stuart Lee as well. Thank you very much to Sky Potato, GoFasterStripe.com and Fuzz, who are all producing this together. Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends to come and listen to another podcast. Thank you. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.